He is the new voice of talk radio, Alexander Danilov.
And hello, everybody. Welcome back to Solutionsology Radio. My quest when I created the show many years ago and then pivoted and evolved it and created what it is today, Solutionsology Radio, was to continue to provide people with information that either they weren't getting somewhere else or they were, but not the right way, meaning that it was just getting run over, just made to fill in time. And I hated that. I always wanted to make sure that I provided my audience with the right rich content that would help them in their lives. And one of the concepts I always go back to, one of the topics I always go back to, is finance, financial literacy. And I keep harking on this. And I had Ben Carlson last week, the author of A Wealth of Common Sense, on to continue talking about this. And I will continue doing so because the regular media, books, whatever, do a good job of doing this. But there are some authors, there are some people out there that do a phenomenal job of helping us understand what money is, what finance is, why we should understand it, why we shouldn't be averse to it. And my interview today, I'm actually going to be interviewing Jonathan Clements. He's the author of How to Think About Money and a slew of other books I'll mention later on. He also worked about 20 years at the Wall Street Journal as a financial columnist. I can't think of a better person to have on to talk about the all-important topic of financial literacy. So without further ado, John, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about this topic.
Hey, I really appreciate it, Alex. It's great to be on your show.
Absolutely. It's great to have you. So the book I mentioned before, How to Think About Money, I have it in front of me. It was great. You were gracious enough to send it out to me. So I want to get right into it. And what I like to do is actually read from and point to certain sections of the book. So let's get to actually the early stages of the book. I want to read this part. It's part six, page four, for those keeping score at home. Academics tout the idea of so-called consumption smoothing, borrowing heavily when you're young, then paying off those debts when you're old so as to maintain a constant standard of living throughout your life. And then you go on, this is a really, really dumb idea, since it ignores habituation. You get into a little further. I could not agree with you more on that side. George Washington, if he had seen how debt is used today, would just absolutely rue the day, would not want any part of this kind of system. So let's talk about this and this kind of indoctrination of making people comfortable with debt and getting into debt, especially at a very young and very vulnerable age.
Well, I don't think we should depict debt as evil. It's really a question of degree, right? Most Correct. Of us, if we couldn't take on debt, you know, we'd never be able to go to college, we'd never be able to buy our first car, we'd never be able to buy our first home, or if we did, you know, none of these things would happen until we were in our 40s. So taking on debt is not an unreasonable thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of us in our 20s end up taking on a fairly large amount of debt, but one of the reasons we can do that is we know that ahead of us lies these four decades of paychecks that allow us to service those debts and, you know, fingers crossed, get all those debts paid off by the time we retire. The problem is people overdo it. And, you know, that goes to this notion of habituation. You know, you don't want to get used to flying first class in your 20s, because if you get used to flying first class in your 20s, life is never going to get any better. What you want to do is fly economy in your 20s, so that when in your 40s and 50s you manage to get upgraded to business class or even first class, it seems like something special. You know, if you're eating at gourmet restaurants from day one, you know, it's not going to be uphill from there. And in fact, life is going to feel like it's all downhill.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we're going to talk about and keep pointing back to is really looking at things through the long term. And that's something that's become a little bit foreign. I agree with you. Debt is, it's not important. We shouldn't look at it as the worst thing on earth, but we should be very careful how we get into it. And we're seeing such a problem with student debt and things like that. But that's also the results aspect of it. We got to make sure that if we're doing it, that it ends up being the right move for us. But let's talk about money as a whole. And perplexing nature of money you talk about in really throughout the book, but specifically about its relationship to happiness. And that's something I want to focus on here, because we all know the two maxims that so many people go by: money's a root of all evil, money can't buy happiness. I disagree to a large extent of that, but you point to a lot of facts and you point to a lot of surveys in this section of the book. So I want to talk about that and get into that part of it.
So when we think about money and happiness, it's important to go back to a key study. It was done by an economist called Richard Easterlin, and it came out in 1974. And Easterlin pointed out what's come to be known as the Easterlin paradox. And the paradox is this: throughout the post-war period, the standard of living in the U.S., Japan, and elsewhere has soared. You know, we're living so much better than previous generations were, and yet our reported level of happiness has barely budged. And so the question is, what's going on here? And one of the key ideas floating around happiness research is this idea of the hedonic treadmill or hedonic adaptation. And the notion is this: we imagine that if we get that next pay raise or that next promotion, we buy the bigger house or the brand new car, it's all going to be better. But last year, maybe we got the pay raise we always wanted, and things aren't all better. You know, sure, you know, we were thrilled when we initially got that pay raise, but soon enough, hedonic adaptation kicks in. We're used to the extra money, we're back to feeling dissatisfied, and we're hankering after something else. And this sort of cycle of striving and then dissatisfaction, I think we can blame on our hunter-gatherer ancestors. We're here today because our hunter-gatherer ancestors strove relentlessly for more and were never satisfied with what they had. That's why they were able to survive and reproduce. And within us, we still carry those instincts. So we strive, but we're never satisfied with what we achieve, so that we keep on striving. And this is why it's so difficult to buy more happiness. We get the extra money, but it doesn't deliver the long-term satisfaction that we imagine.
Right. And I mean, part of that is obviously the fulfilling nature of it. Part of it is human nature, is where no matter what we have, whether it's a lot or a little, we're never going to be ultimately satisfied with that. But there's things that we can do with that that makes it more fulfilling or makes it more satisfying to have that cash on hand in our pockets, in our bank accounts, whatever, helping people, spending time socializing. You mentioned the amazing power of intimacy with couples towards the latter part of that chapter. But also socializing, getting involved with people, and doing things with people. And some start charities, some, you know, just use it as an opportunity to go out more. So there is ways to leverage that, you know, financial flexibility to be able to create that happiness. You know, if money is obviously at the end of the day just a way that we keep score of certain things. But if paperclips were a currency, we'd all be chasing paperclips and not happy whoever had the most. So it's the same idea.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Alex. But there are, as you suggest, ways that we can use money to buy happiness. You know, one of the things, the big mistakes that people make is they use their money to buy more and more possessions. But the problem with possessions is, you know, we have to look after them. There's a lot of upkeep involved, and then they deteriorate over time. So possessions go from being a source of happiness initially to being a source of unhappiness. By contrast, a lot of things that you talked about, you know, and that are in the book, are indeed potential sources of long-term happiness. Things like using our money to buy experiences rather than possessions, using our money to create special times with friends and family. And another one, which you didn't mention, I think is really crucial, and I devote chapter two to, is using our money to design a life for ourselves where we can spend our days doing what we're passionate about. We all imagine that what we really want to do is retire and relax, but we're not built to relax. What we're built to do is to strive, but what you want to do is strive at things that you think are important and that you think you're good at, you find challenging, and that you're passionate about. So what you want to do is use your money to design a life for yourself where you can spend your days doing those things that you love and you find fulfilling.
Absolutely, Jonathan. And that's actually, that was the Bet on a Long Life chapter. That was actually next in my notes that we were going to. So I appreciate the segue here. But in that chapter, you discuss something many people look forward to, as you mentioned, the most fear, right? Because we don't really know what it's going to be. What are we going to do? Are our brains going to turn to mush? What happens if we have enough money? They fear that it'll come, and they won't. And at the same time, they feared that it's not going to come. Right, we're not going to have the opportunity to retire, or at least partially retire. And part of that is because over time we'd either been fed kind of like myths of you know, financial freedom, how to get there, what we put our money into, the liabilities we purchased, like cars, instead of maybe purchasing a rental property and creating passive income so we can enjoy that later on. So let's talk about that in that section of the book specifically, because we're supposed to, if nothing happens, no freak incidents happen, we're supposed to be able to live a long and more or less healthy life. 75 to 80 years is not uncommon anymore. 80 and plus is not something that's like, oh my God, I can't believe it lasted this long. So that's more of a common thing now. So one of the things you talk about is delaying at least, and very importantly, delaying taking full Social Security benefits till 70, and then after that, being able to create and enjoy a life that you've built over this time.
Yeah, so there's two aspects to retirement. One is the financial aspect, and that's the aspect that we become heavily focused on. Wall Street is constantly pushing us to save for retirement, put money in our IRAs, put money in 401k plans, and it's all about, you know, meeting this financial obligation. But, you know, even if you strive to meet this financial obligation, to have enough money to retire, you also want to give a lot of thought to what are you going to do with all that free time? Trust me, you are not going to be happy sitting around spending the last 20 or 30 years of your life relaxing. That simply
Yep.
doesn't make for a satisfying life. In fact, one of the things I argue in the book is that we need to break down this distinction between work and retirement and really see retirement as an extension of work. What retirement represents is a chance to continue to be out there in the world, to continue to take on new challenges without worrying so much about whether they come with a paycheck. When I think about my own retirement, I think about it as a continuation of my time in the workforce. The only difference is, you know, maybe I'll be less focused on making money and free up time to do things where I'm not going to get paid, but I still want to get up every morning and have a sense of purpose, to have something on the agenda for the day, because that's what gives you that sense of fulfillment. That's what gives a sense of purpose to your life. And people, if they focus on, okay, I just got to make it to 65, I got to have my $1 million or whatever it is you think you're going to retire, and then I'm going to relax and play golf and go out to lunch every day, you're not going to be happy. That will make you happy for 2 weeks, maybe three, and then after that, all that relaxation is going to turn to profound boredom.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to make you miserable at the end of the day as well. So that's something that we need to obviously watch out for. There's a plan that we need to have, not just when we're retired, but also on a regular day basis, so we feel fulfilled. And everybody hates task lists and to-do lists, but how good does it feel when we get to scratch that off? You know, it feels amazing when we get to the point at the end and this list is done. But that doesn't mean you're done. It means you start off on a new list and you start doing something else, tackling something bigger, something more important, or just something that will at least kill some time, make you feel good about it after.
Yeah, one of the notions in the book that I wrote without thinking that it would be controversial, but actually I've had a lot of reaction to, and mostly good reaction, but not entirely. One of the notions I advance in the book is this idea that when we're in our 20s, what we should do is not focus on making money. What we should do in our 20s is pursue our passions. This is the time when, you know, we try to become a Broadway actor, or, you know, we try to become a poet or a painter, or we, you know, see if we can make it as a rock musician or whatever it is. And this whole notion is based on an underlying idea that pursuing our passions in our 20s is somehow more important than pursuing our passions in our 40s or 50s or 60s. I think that is complete nonsense, and in fact, the literature suggests just the opposite. When you're in your 20s, you tend to get a lot of satisfaction from external rewards, from getting those promotions and pay raises and moving up the corporate ladder. By the time you get to your 40s and 50s, you are not satisfied with that stuff. You realize the pay raises and the promotions haven't brought you a whole lot of happiness, and instead you become more focused on things that you find intrinsically satisfying that are important to you, not important to your employer, and that's when pursuing your passions becomes important. So what do I say when I talk to people in their 20s, when I talk to college graduates? I say, go out there, get as high-paying job as you can, save as much money as you can, because 20 years down the road, you're going to be really grateful to have that money, because at that point, you really will want to pursue your passion, and you're going to want to have the financial flexibility to do that.
Absolutely. Once again, speaking with Jonathan Clements, we're having a fantastic conversation on finance, money, money management and the mental component of it too, which is being able to think about money the right way and being flexible about it. John's also the author of several other books, including The Money Guide, which is an annual edition. 2016 is out, 2017 right around the corner. 48 and Counting, A Story of Money, Love and Bicycling, The Little Book of Main Street Money, and we're probably going to be talking about those these other books in the coming weeks. But right now we're focusing on how to think about money, and it's a phenomenal book. It's small. Most people can read it in probably an afternoon, maybe a day or two. For me, it takes a little longer because I take a lot of notes, and obviously I'm having you on the show, John, so it's a little different. But I do love the book, and I love the different aspects of it. One of the things that I admire, and well, one of the things I really enjoyed in the book, is that you also talk about the markets and the psychology of all of this. And going to the pages in the 70s, I'm a trader. I love to trade. This is what I want to do. I want to be able to move off working for somebody else, trade, make money doing that, but write. That's my goal in life. I love to write. I love to read. I love to consume knowledge. But one of the things I struggle with is the mental component of trading and money as a whole is selling my winners quickly, hanging on to losers, which I'm in a cotton position right now. I'm not very happy about. And then what other people, and this is something I don't have a big problem with, but taking credit and being so happy to talk about our winners, whether we made $5, $100, $1,000, but we blame other people, the market, everything's rigged, the media, all this kind of stuff for our losses. And that's true of everything in life, not just the markets. But let's talk about that in the psychological component of money and the chase of it.
Yeah, one of the problems with investing, with managing money in general, is that our measure of whether we made a good decision or a bad decision is whether the decision turned out well.
Yep.
I mean, that is our yardstick for whether a decision was good or bad. But you can think of plenty of financial decisions that you make where you ended up with more money in your pocket, but actually it was a really dumb decision. And let me give you a very simple example. If you own your home, you can save yourself hundreds of dollars a year, maybe more than $1,000, by not having homeowners insurance, right? And most of the time, that's, you know, will be a profitable decision. You will save the insurance premiums by not having homeowners insurance. But of course, if it turns out to be the year that your house burns down, it's a disastrous decision. So just because you can make money in any one year by not having homeowners insurance doesn't mean it's a smart decision. You know, by the same token, we make investment decisions and we make money on them, but it doesn't mean that it was a smart investment decision. So you could go out and you could bet everything on one stock. That stock could double in value over the next 12 months. Clearly, you'd be a whole lot richer, but you can't argue that that was a prudent decision. So when you think about investing and, you know, don't focus just on whether the decision made you money or not. Think about whether you were rational in how you behaved and whether you were prudent in how you behaved.
Absolutely. So with the book here, you mentioned some of the controversies that you've encountered with this book, but obviously you've gotten a lot of feedback for the book. I think it's a fantastic book. But let's talk about the people telling us what they take the most from and how they've changed themselves, because at the end of the day, part of the reason you wrote this book is to be able to help somebody or help a group of people. And that's the point of it, right? You've done that through years of working with the Wall Street Journal and being a financial columnist and helping people understand the machinations of money, macro and micro. But in this book, I would like to know what people took from it. I took a lot of different things from it. I'd like to know what your general audience did.
In terms of the way it should influence people in managing their money, I mean, we've talked about how to use money to buy happiness. You know, favor experiences over possessions, use your money to create special times with friends and family. You know, we've also talked about money in terms of life stages, how, you know, you might want to buck conventional wisdom and think less about pursuing your passions in your 20s and more about pursuing dollars so that you have the financial freedom to pursue your passions later in life. But another idea, and it's a very basic idea, but it shouldn't be underestimated, is the importance of saving money. Over the years, I have met thousands, literally thousands of everyday Americans who have managed to amass seven-figure portfolios. You know, a lot of these people had relatively modest salaries. Most of them were mediocre investors, but almost all of them shared one attribute in common, and that was this. They were extremely frugal, otherwise known as cheap. In other words, they were great savers, and that's why they were able to accumulate those seven-figure portfolios. Back in 1996, there was a famous book written called The Millionaire Next Door, written by two authors, William Danko and Tom Stanley, and it talks about this notion of the millionaire next door, the couple who, you know, live in the modest home, they drive secondhand cars, they don't have designer clothes, and yet, if you saw their investment accounts, you'd be shocked because they have these seven-figure portfolios. You know, if there's anything that you can do to ensure your own financial success, it's to live beneath your means and save great gulps of money every month. It is indeed as simple as that.
Absolutely. So once again, the book we spoke about today is How to Think About Money. Jonathan Clements, is a foreword by William Bernstein there as well. I encourage everyone to go at the very least to your website and read more about you, learn more about you. They could also follow you on Twitter at Clements Money as the handle. Your website is jonathanclements.com. Hope to have you on again, talk about these other books that you have. And for those that are listening, will listen, download and share. Money Guide 2015, 2016, and soon 2017 will be out. And this is an annual thing, which is good because concepts change and where we should invest changes. You talk about bonds and stuff like that on your sites as well and your blog entry. So I encourage people to check that out. John, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for the nice note in the book that you sent me.
Oh, my pleasure, Alex.
Thanks so much for coming on.